Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, marking nearly 50 years of commitment to operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System. More at alyeskapipeline.com.
Welcome to Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Twardot. David Hart is one of many Alaskans with impressive mountaineering resumes that few people know about. Dave's early formative years were spent playing in his backyard of the Tugatch Mountains. He left the state and discovered rock climbing, technical mountaineering, and peat bagging in Colorado. Dave eventually moved back to Alaska for his professional career and a full life in the mountains. He has climbed over 1,550 peaks worldwide, including more than 550 in Alaska. This includes the 13 highest peaks in Alaska and the 13 highest in Canada. He joins me to discuss his approach to mountaineering and related risks, what he looks for in a good climbing partner, the importance of groups such as the Alaska Mountaineering Club, and his latest passion, peak bagging. Stay tuned for Outdoor Explorer. You are listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Paul Twardot. I have Dave Hart in the studio with me. We're talking about his very productive and long career of climbing in Alaska and elsewhere. Welcome to the show, Dave.
Paul, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
Yeah, so you have just an amazing climbing resume, 45 years of climbs, over 1,500 peaks. We were talking earlier, some almost 600 peaks in Alaska, and then add on to that a bunch of 8,000 meter peaks. Very impressive.
Thanks. Yeah, I've definitely been fortunate to spend a lot of time in the mountains during my lifetime.
Well, I'm sure I am looking forward to hearing some of your stories, and I'm sure our listeners are too. So let's just start with what got you interested in climbing. You sort of grew up here, right?
I did. I'm 58 years old, and I lived here in grade school in the 70s for 5 years, and then I moved back after I graduated from college in 1990. So I've been here for 36 years since I became an adult.
Yeah. So in grade school, were you outside romping through the woods?
Yeah. You know, back in the 70s, when you got home from school, you just go outside and play with your friends, and you just spend a lot of time outside. No video games, no cell stuff. So,
yeah.
I mean, just it was by nature a lot of time spent outside. I remember Earthquake Park, you know, in the 70s. It wasn't that long after the earthquake, the 64 earthquake.
Yeah.
So, you know, we'd go out there and pick mushrooms, just play around the woods. So we spent a lot of time outside.
Huh. And do you remember the first sort of mountain? Like, I remember my first mountain was, you know, this hill probably that wasn't really anything, but I remember as a kid as it being a mountain. Do you remember something like that as a kid?
Yeah. So I don't have a lot of memories from growing up here in Alaska in the 70s, early 70s, but a couple of the memories I have is we went out to Wonder Lake as a family and camped and hiked around. And I remember seeing, you know, the big, big mountains out there.
Yeah.
And that kind of stuck with me.
Yeah.
And then one of the pictures I have that I enjoy is Crow Pass. You know, we hiked up to Crow Pass, and I just remember that. So not really mountain experiences as a young child, but certainly a lot of nice outdoor activity experiences.
Yeah. And so you left Alaska, and how did your outdoor interest, you know, continue? How did you pursue things from there?
And we always lived in mountainous states, Colorado, New Mexico. New Mexico, we lived kind of on the edge of town, so you'd have a dirt bike and you'd go cruise around the desert and just play outside. And then probably the most formative part of my outdoor career was in high school in Colorado Springs. They had a formalized outdoor education program that I participated in. And that's where I learned to rock climb and ice climb and camp and ski and all the things that then led me into my lifetime of outdoor mountaineering.
Yeah. And so that was part of college?
That was high school.
Oh, high school.
Yeah,
oh,
I was, wow. I'm fortunate I went to a boarding school in Colorado Springs, so very formalized, structured outdoor activities and other sports. But so that got me into really the climbing, camping, backpacking scene. And then once I went to college in Colorado, I continued that on my own and then moved up here afterwards.
Oh, it's a great place to learn and work down
there. It is.
Right. And what was your major? What did you study?
I got a degree in petroleum engineering, graduated in 90, and of course, I had two choices. I could move to Texas or move to Anchorage, and I did a summer internship in Anchorage the year before, so I knew I wanted to come back up here. So that brought me back up here 36 years ago.
And was that part of your like self-story, like, oh, I grew up in Anchorage, I got to go back a little bit?
Well, by then, I was very into rock climbing, mountain climbing, and there's no question that the choices I had, Alaska or Texas, Alaska is where I was coming back to.
Yeah. Huh. And what year? That was 90?
90.
All right. Yep. And then, so you're back here. What did you do? Like, what was some of the first stuff you did up here?
I joined the Mountaineering Club of Alaska, you know, not knowing anybody up here. Yeah. That's a very good tool to meet people and to learn skills and to go on trips. It's a great organization. I'm still a member 36 years later. So I met a lot of friends through that. And then once you get into the community, then there's endless opportunities to go on trips with folks.
Right. And do you have a memory of a first, you know, like a significant peak or something, like one of your first things up here that stand out?
So the first big peak I did up here, you know, I spent a lot of time in the Chugach, and I still do, but the first big peak was Denali in 92 with some friends. So we had a trip up there.
Right.
And then subsequent to that, many, many other big trips up here in Alaska.
Well, and what, was that the West Buttress? Or what was that?
West Rib.
West Rib. Yeah. Okay. Tell us a little bit about that climb.
Okay, yeah, the West Rib, our West Rib expedition in 92 was very formative for me, maybe not in a good way. A group of four of us went in there, had great weather, great trip. So I was 24, group of friends I'd been climbing with, some for many years, a couple for just several years. And on our summit day, we started off as our group of four. Two turned back, just weren't feeling it. And then my buddy Brian and I went to the summit, nice climb. And on the descent, we got separated. I was traveling a little bit faster and made the mistake, if you will, of just getting too far in front of him, not really staying together as I should have in retrospect. And he ended up needing the assistance of Nick Parker's mountain trip guided expedition to get down the West Rib. So, you know, in retrospect, of course, I should have stayed with Brian and thanks to Nick and his team, they ended up getting him down. But that was very a good learning experience for me. Not how one should do that in the mountains. So I mean, it's really hard for me to talk about now. But you know, I learned a lot of that trip.
Well, thanks for sharing that, because sometimes those experiences are the most valuable if you can learn from them.
Without a doubt. Yeah. I mean, no excuse. I was 24 and young and first big Alaskan expedition. You know, Denali is easy when the weather's good, and it's just impossible when the weather's bad. And we had good weather, but just the sequence of events, Brian needed some help getting down. And
And Nick is a longtime mountaineer, a guide, and well-known in the rescue community up here for all his exploits.
He's a legend in Alaska mountaineering.
Right,
a legend.
And a long time, people might know him as a ski wax worth of damage for a long time.
Exactly.
After that, what shaped you after that then? After that climb, you kept going. I mean, at it.
So. Without a doubt. I mean, that was my first big Alaska expedition. And subsequent to that, over the last 30 plus years, I've been on 50 Alaska expeditions. Well, between Alaska and the Canadian Arctic, you know, the Wrangell-St. Elias National Park and the Alaska Mountains. And I've kept going. I guess my last one was 2 years ago. So I've spent a lot of time in the big mountains of Alaska and Canada.
Yeah. Yeah. So explain that a little bit to folks in big mountains, because I look at your resume, it's just overwhelming. It's like there's so much here. Like, how do you pick objectives? How do you plan for these things? How do you, like, make things work? Is it organic, or have you always had a plan in mind from year to year?
So it has evolved. You know, when in the early 90s, there was very little web-based apps and things. You just looked at a map and you knew the big mountains and you said, well, we did Denali, let's go do Foraker and Hunter. And then, okay, then there's the Wrangell St. Elias Mountains, let's go over there. And so we basically, not really having a list, but just doing the big peaks because they're hard and challenging and it takes a lot of dedication and luck. And and we were good at that, fit and strong. And I had my buddy Paul Berry, who we did 20 or 30 expeditions together and ended up climbing 20 of the 22 highest peaks in the Arctic together. And so we went on a lot of trips for 15 years. So I guess it was organic in that we would go on a trip and we'd have a good time and we'd say, let's go do something else. And you look at the map and you just keep picking these big peaks out.
Yeah, yeah. Huh. And what talk about partners a little bit, and what makes a good partner, and what you mentioned Paul, like how that's an important component to a trip.
It really is, and I think that's part of the attraction of the sport of mountain climbing is those relationships you have with your partners.
Yeah.
I'm hesitant to go do anything of consequence with people I don't know. It's just not as fun.
Yeah.
But Paul and I think our first trip was into the Wrangells for Mount Bona in 94. And our last one was in 2007, so 14 years.
Oh, wow.
Doing one or two or three peaks a year, big trips. So he and I were a core of that time period of my life. And then we had many other friends who would join us for 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5 of these trips.
Yeah.
But each of these trips are 2 to 3 weeks long, nominally with a 50% success rate. And our success rate was much higher than that. Because of the dedication, I guess.
Yeah.
And the willingness to put up with the many unpleasant things associated with snow camping and blizzards and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And risk. I mean, there's no doubt that these big mountains have risk and you can mitigate a lot of it, but sometimes there's just things that you can't predict or expect or so I never enjoyed the risk aspect of the mountain climbing. You know, people think, oh, mountain climbing, you like to get that adrenaline rush. That was the thing I hated the most about
it. Oh, interesting.
I despise the adrenaline rush and the fear. Yeah. So I did everything I could to minimize that.
I imagine that's pretty important in a partner. About picking a partner is having the same risk tolerance.
Without a doubt. Yeah, and just to be open with each other. And, you know, Paul was and still is just hugely strong. So he would brick trail, but we had, you know, most of the trips we went on were with partners, you know, one or two or three partners. Yeah. But we did a couple trips where it was just he and I on big mountains, Mount Vancouver, mm-hmm. down on the Canadian-Alaskan border, just two guys dropped off in an airplane in the middle of nowhere. We did a new route up a 16,000-foot peak. And
impressive.
That was pretty amazing.
Yeah. And how long did that take you, as an example? Okay, people don't know, 16,000 foot, that sounds awfully big. You know, you're probably starting near sea level. Like, how would that look like?
I forget the base elevation, maybe 7,000 feet. Mm-hmm. So we had two camps on the mountain. You know, you go to the summit from your 14,000 foot camp, and then, so 3 days to the summit, and then a day down. So 4 days total.
Yeah.
But then we had some weather to get out, so I can't remember. Maybe it was a 10-day trip or something.
Okay.
But
yeah,
and that's pretty thrilling. These big mountains get so few ascents. You know, Denali is beautiful in its own way, but there's hundreds of people there.
Yeah,
and you go to many of the other big mountains in Alaska and Canada, and aside from Logan and Denali, there's nobody there. And I think that's what really kept me attracted to these peaks is just the total remoteness. You're just relying on yourself.
Yeah.
I remember one of the trips into Canada, it was five of us, and we were camped on this ridge at 13,000 feet, and we all piled into our big three-man tent playing cards one night, just late at night, and we just said to ourselves, I can't believe we are in the middle of nowhere, camping in the snow on a ridge, playing cards in a tent, just squeezed in here, it's just, it's surreal. It's unreal.
Oh, yeah.
And that's what I think kept attracting me, is just it's so implausible to be there, to climb these mountains.
Yeah. Implausible, but you're there.
So, right.
Yeah.
Right.
Sort of because of that.
Yeah. You look at it, you look at these mountains from the bottom and you think, how in the world would you get up there?
Right.
But you can't have that perspective when you're in the mountains. You look at each footstep or each camp or each day or each half day, and you make a little bit of progress at a time, and then it's not bad. So you can't look at the big picture, or you would never go.
Right. Yeah. And a lot of these trips, did you have information? Did you have beta beforehand, or there was a lot of it just going sort of blind?
So I like to increase, I like to have the maximum chance of success. So I do a lot of research, and the American Alpine Journal has a lot of trip reports, and the Mountaineering Club of Alaska newsletter, the SCREE, has a lot of trip reports. But back in the 90s and 2000s, right, there was less data available, and it was hard copy data. You know, no satellite imagery. It was harder to get around. No GPS, no cell phone. So it was, I think about what we did 30 years ago, and now it's just easier.
Right.
But we would try and get as much information as we could so that we had a higher chance of success. But we also did routes that hadn't ever been climbed, or peaks that hadn't ever been climbed before. And that's pretty exciting too.
Right. And do you think that more information, it sounds like you like information, you want, but do you think that's subtracted or added to the experiences, having the satellite images and all the, you know, information that can be garnered through remote sensing nowadays?
So it takes away some of the mystery, no doubt.
Yeah.
The nice thing about information is you can either choose to use it or not. Mm-hmm. So there are people who truly enjoy the mystery associated with getting dropped off and making their own way and figuring it out themselves. And I totally respect that. There's some very amazing outdoor athletes in Alaska who do tremendous things. Luke Mell is one of the very few. Yeah. Clint Helander. I mean, some amazing outdoor athletes up here. I'm at maybe the other end of the spectrum, where I like to have as much information as I can. I'm an engineer, so that's, I think, by nature who I am. And it's just a different way of approaching it.
Yeah. You are listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Paul Twardock. I have Dave Hart in the studio with me. We're talking about his very productive and long career of climbing in Alaska and elsewhere. Let's go to some of the more memorable climbs. You have some ones that stand out, or some experiences that you, you know, we've got into the 90s, you're climbing. Talk to us a little bit about maybe even those early years.
Interesting. So certainly the late 90s is when I was most productive. You know, I was 30 years old, very fit, very motivated.
Yeah.
Had fit and motivated friends. And so some of the most interesting climbs for me in retrospect, Mount Nattezat is in eastern Alaska, very close to the Canadian border, 13,000 feet, only had one ascent 100 years ago.
And, wow, that's an interesting story right
not,
there. Yeah.
Not quite 100 years ago, but 80 years ago.
But, yeah.
And our friends Harry Hunt and Danny Coast tried a new route up the North Ridge the year prior and didn't make it. And so Harry said, let's go back. So Harry Hunt, Dave Lucy, Paul Berry, and myself flew in, and Paul Claus with Ultima Thule dropped us off. And early April, very cold. I don't like April trips anymore because they're cold. But we spent, I don't know, 5 days on the mountain. Not an easy route, not like, you know, Alaska grade 4, I think is what we called it. So not extreme, but not easy.
Yep.
5 days on the mountain, 4 camps, and made the first ascent of that North Ridge, second ascent ever. That was very memorable. Very, very nice peak.
So for people who don't understand, explain the grading system.
The Alaska Alpine climbing grade system is 1 to 6. Mm-hmm. You know, 1 is just a walk up a flat glacier. 6 is the south face of Denali. That's vertical ice and rock and very, very difficult.
Yeah.
So 4 is, I mean, it's difficult. I mean, if you fall, you have to have protection to protect yourself.
So
you basically don't fall.
Yeah.
So that, I mean, that was at the limit of my abilities and desires. I did, you know, the West River Denali was a 4, I think the Hunter route we did, Mount Hunter was 3+ maybe, or, yeah, and that was a 4-. So that was at the limits of my interest and abilities.
Yeah.
And maybe that's why the ones that are most interesting for me were the ones that pushed me at that limit.
Yeah.
Like the Mount Vancouver trip with Paul, that was, you know, technical climbing. And
yeah. And are these mostly snow and ice, or is there some rock involved in these larger peaks?
It depends. So Denali has a lot of rock climbing on the steeper routes, mostly snow and ice, but you can do rock climbing. But most of the peaks, just thinking back, are all snow and ice.
Mm-hmm.
Just they're high elevation, glaciated. And since I didn't do the extreme climbs, the grade fives or sixes, those involve more rock climbing, which I didn't do.
Yeah. And then, so you're in Alaska, and your resume is just incredible. You talk about 13,000 foot peaks and higher. Like, how many of those are there? How do we define that? How do you wrap your head around what's a peak and what's not a peak? And I know there's been some controversy in the past about this.
Yeah, that's
in the climbing community. So
That's a funny topic. So imagine if you flooded the earth up to the level of 13,000 feet. Anything that sticks up above 13,000 feet, you know, may or may not be a peak, depending how much it sticks up above the saddle. So it's called the deciding factor is called prominence.
Uh-huh.
So how much above the highest saddle to a higher peak does a peak stand? Like flat top, everybody climbs flat top. I think its prominence to peak two is less than 200 feet. So yeah, it's theoretically, close. It's not a dedicated peak, distinct peak, because it doesn't have enough prominence. It's a high point on the ridge to peak two and peak three.
Yeah. Huh.
So Alaska typically, like in the Chugach State Park behind Anchorage, which is a wonderful playground, the cutoff to determine what is a distinct peak is 500 feet. So from a peak, you have to be able to drop down 500 feet before you climb up to the next higher peak. So there's 120 peaks in the Chugach with that 500-foot criteria. Colorado, for example, only uses 300 feet. If you were to apply a 300-foot prominence cutoff to the Chugach State Park peaks, I think it adds another 40 or 50 peaks with all these sub-peak bumps.
That's a lot. Yeah.
So the big question is, what is a peak? It's like the North Peak of Denali. People don't consider that a separate peak, but it actually has a 1,600-foot or 1,400-foot drop to the saddle. So theoretically, it's a separate peak, but it's not really defined as such because it blends in to the massif, the Denali massif.
Yeah.
So that will never be settled of what is a separate peak.
Yeah. Well, and that's Denali is a good example because that's a difficult thing to do. If you're going to go do both of them, it's probably not going to do in one day.
Right.
You're not going to go over the north and go to the south, right?
Or right. Whatever, right. That is very true.
Right.
Huh. Yeah.
Yeah. And so given that 500 foot, well, one question is why was Colorado a 300 foot difference in Alaska 500? Any idea?
I don't know. Certainly in Colorado, there's millions of people and hundreds of thousands that climb there. And they're easy to access. And I don't know why. That's just been historically what they've done. Okay. Same in California. So the lower 48 typically uses 300 foot of prominence.
Right.
But if you were to use 300 foot of prominence on Denali, for example, there would be the North Peak, which would qualify with its 1,500 foot of prominence. There's two other points on the east side of the mountain that would qualify because they have over 500 feet of prominence, but they're not separate peaks. They're just
part
bumps.
Part of
Mount Logan, similarly, would, if you used a 500 foot criteria, there'd be, I don't know, six peaks on Mount Logan, whereas in reality, there's only Mount Logan and some sub peaks.
Right. So back to your climbing.
Yeah.
So what have you, like, how many have you done over 13,000? Like, what's your, like, What are you proud of? I guess one question. Way to put it.
I don't know. I mean, I've got it written down. I don't know how many 13ers in Alaska I've done, but what I've, I guess, been focusing on growing up in Colorado are 14ers.
Right.
So in Alaska, I've done the 13 highest peaks in Alaska.
Oh, that's right. The 13 and, number from.
And they're all over 14,000 feet. And then I've also done the 13 highest peaks in Canada, all of which are in the Arctic. Four of them are shared border peaks, Mount St. Elias, for example. So in the aggregate area of Alaska and the Canadian Arctic, my buddy Paul and I both, we've done the 22 highest peaks in that combined region, which we didn't start off with that our objective. We just happened to spend so much time in the mountains that over 15 or 20 years, we managed to do that. So imagine if you're flying from Seattle to Anchorage, sit on the right side of the airplane, and just look at that sea of mountains on the coast.
Yeah.
anything over 14,000 feet, with the exception of there's three we haven't done, and we've done those 22 peaks, which is, I mean, I'm still, I fly up and I try and get a right-hand side seat so I can look at these. And I think, I can't believe I was there, and there.
Yeah.
So I guess proud might be the word, but you know, we didn't do it to feel proud. It just happened to be that way. And,
right.
But it's great memories. I mean, I flew up last year, perfect day, and you just watch the whole sea of peaks, mm-hmm. Logan and St. Elias and King Peak. And I mean, every one of those big peaks, I just look out and think, wow, I was there 20 or 25 years ago.
Yeah.
So that's pretty cool.
And you mentioned earlier about a 50% success rate. Maybe you guys had a higher success rate. How many of these did you have to persevere? On average, or like, is there one in particular that took more than a couple of times to go get?
That's pretty funny. So our success rate, you know, I think I probably did 50 expeditions into the Canadian, Alaskan, Arctic. I think our success rate was over 90%.
Oh, wow.
And I mean, there's a reason for that. You know, many people who do Denali, for example, don't understand how unpleasant it is. It's very unpleasant.
Mm-hmm.
And
cold-wise.
Cold and just everything takes so long. Just cooking water, melting snow and making food and shoveling camps. It's a lot of work.
Yeah.
It's beautiful and very fulfilling, but many people who aren't experienced in that quickly find that they don't like it. You know,
right.
Nothing wrong with that. So that's part of it. Other times people are on a constrained schedule and the weather is horrible up here on these big peaks. And so you get into a storm, it delays your travels and the storm ends and you think, I want to go down. So you go down.
Yeah.
So we almost never had constraints on the end.
Mm-hmm.
So we have turned around for avalanche danger or whatever. But we never turned around just because we ran out of time.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for example, Mount Logan, it was horrible weather. I think we were on Mount Logan for 4 weeks, the East Ridge, difficult route. We were trapped at our high camp we were up there for 10 days, most of which in a snow cave.
Yeah.
Horrible experience, but never in any danger. You just lay there for a week in a tent or a snow cave and just hope that the storm ends soon. But the peak, to answer your original question, the peak that we had to spend the most time on was by Mount Logan. It's called King Peak, mm-hmm. just under 17,000 feet. Beautiful shark tooth fin sticking up out of the ridge of Mount Logan. And we took four successive years, 2001, 2002, 2003, and finally in 2004, we made it to the summit. So that took a lot of perseverance.
Yeah. And was that because of weather or route selection or like?
The first two times, 2001 and 2, we tried the Southwest Ridge. It was hard. It was technical, roped climbing, setting protection. First year, we turned back because of weather. Second year, we made it to the false summit. And then from there to the true summit, it had only been climbed one time in 1967 by a Japanese team. And so you could see some of their fixed line and pitons along the route. Uh-huh. And we get to the false summit 2 miles away from the true summit. We're at 15,000 feet. And we crest the ridge looking where we needed to go. And it was double corniced and impossible for us.
Yeah.
Obviously, they did it. But they fixed ropes and it took them weeks to siege this mountain. And we were just four people with some camping gear. So it became
a little more than that. But yeah.
But we got up there and it was very clear that we weren't going to.
Right.
So we camped on the summit and then the next day rappelled back down.
On the false summit.
And that was disappointing because that was a second try.
Yeah.
And the funny thing, when we were rappelling down, I dropped my rappel device right on the first rappel.
Oh, boy.
It just tumbled thousands of feet down the mountain. I thought, oh, that's not good. there are ways. You just make a carabiner rappel. Not a big deal, but just very ironic. You're at the top of this big mountain and you drop your rappel device. So that was not great.
Yeah.
And then the next 2 years, we went back the standard route. It had only been climbed a handful of times, but we went back to a equally difficult but shorter route. So basically you can ski to 14,000 feet and then it's only a 3,000 foot climb. It was a 24-hour climb.
Mm-hmm.
And the third attempt, we were on that route, but the weather was bad. And then the fourth attempt, we finally made it.
Oh, nice. That's impressive. Headlight drop, and then that just goes to show like experience and having like, the belay device that you knew how to manage it, right. Solve a problem, right. Basically.
Yeah, I mean, I don't remember a lot from then, you know, 30 years ago, yeah. But I distinctly remember standing, just watching my yellow. It was a tuber, was the name of
right,
it. Just
tuber.
Ding, 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 ding. Oh, like, oh my gosh.
You are listening to Outdoor Explorer, Alaska Pub Media. I have David Hart with me talking about his many, many years of climbing Alaska and elsewhere, and we'll be right back with more Dave's story after this break.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime, wherever you get your podcasts, or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Twardock. We are talking to Dave Hart about his many decades of climbing in Alaska and elsewhere. Dave, I want to talk about, right before the break, we talked about dropping a rappel device, but that sort of leads us into sort of risk management and stuff like that, because you've obviously been at this for a long, long time and are still here, and you've walked in the building under your own power, so that's great. What kind of things have influenced your... And you also mentioned earlier in the first half about being a fairly risk avoidance, low risk tolerance. What has influenced that? And I'm thinking about particularly an avalanche incident in your past.
Right. Yeah. As we talked about, Paul, yeah. This is difficult to talk about, but in 1992, November, so 33 years ago, some buddies and I were skiing up on Peak 3 above Anchorage here. And you know, in retrospect, we should not have been there, but we were. And three of us got caught in an avalanche up there. We were skiing, whiteout conditions, blowing snow. My friends Bruce and Jeff were above me, out of sight, triggered an avalanche up on the snow slope, you know, below the summit. I just happened to be crossing down lower in the gully, and I got hit from above and washed down the gully several hundred feet. Mm-hmm. And... it got, fortunately, as the snow slide sweeps down the gully, it kicked me out on one of the sides somehow. I don't know how, but it did. Mm-hmm. So I ended up on the edge of the slide watching it go by me. You know, glasses gone, goggles gone, you know, packed full of snow everywhere. And I didn't know what happened, I just had no idea what was going on. Mm-hmm. And I had been above our fourth partner, Peter, who was below me, and then once I kind of got my bearings, I looked up and he was above me because I had been carried down quite a ways. And I just didn't know what was going on, and I didn't do my due diligence of you know, so I'd lost my skis, and so I ended up having to walk down. And I didn't do my due diligence of putting my beak into search mode and checking the debris pile as I went back to the car. And you know, Peter climbed up higher, unbeknownst to me, and kind of figured out what happened. So he came down and we got the Alaska Mountain Rescue Group called out and involved, and you know, our two friends passed away. And horrible, horrible experience, you know, even today, 33 years later. Yeah. You know, never forget that.
Well, thanks for sharing that. I want to bring up from just to realize that even though you've done all these amazing mountaineers, that danger lurks right in our backyard, you know, and that not, I think you mentioned the word complacency, not to be complacent about that.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. So
how many times I've skied Peak 3 and I think about that incident, you know, and
right.
and there was an avalanche this fall on it, or this early winter on it.
Okay.
Yeah. So it caught some people. So
yeah. So yeah. Very, talked about formative events, and obviously that was probably the most formative event of my life and spending time in the outdoors.
Yeah. So from other experiences, how do you prepare? Like, how do you prepare for this, let's say, whether it's in training or, and particularly think about talking to your 22-year-old self, like a listener that's starting off or has a child that's starting off in this. Like what did you do and what do you recommend to train? Not just physically train, but sort of the risk management part of it.
Yes, I mean it's the physical aspect of training is the easy part, I guess, because you spend time in the gym or you carry a heavy pack.
Yeah.
But it's really more than that. Mentally preparing yourself from a safety perspective, which now is to me very important. And there's instruction. You know, finding a mentor who you can go out with on an informal basis, or equally important, taking structured classes. I mean, so many of my friends and I took classes at APU, where they had and still have a very well-known outdoor education program. The Mountaineering Club of Alaska offers training courses, you know, with volunteer instructors, but crevasse training, alpine training, ice climbing training, that's a good way to get structured training. And there's professional guide services, of course, who do a very good job with that. But I mean, I would encourage people to actually take some structured training and learn the fundamentals. And even avalanche, you know, avalanche training is critically important. I mean, I took several classes in the early 90s up at Hatcher Pass with Jill Fredston. And that's, I can't reinforce how important that is. And now it's even more, there's many more courses available, you know, level 1, 2, and 3. And so everybody who spends time in the outdoors, I do some snow machining now to access skiing, and it's good to see that avalanche education and awareness is being focused and emphasized for not only skiers, but snow machiners as well. Right. Anybody who spends time in the outdoors should do something like that.
Yeah, and Jill's and Doug Vessler's, their program has evolved into the Alaska Avalanche School.
So, yes, highly respected.
Yep, and they do a great job, and there are other elder avenues out there learning about avalanches also. And you mentioned the mental part of it. I'm curious about that. Like, how do you mentally prepare for these climbs?
So I think that's something that's it's either there or not. You know, Instagram and social media, people see the beautiful pictures of spending time in the mountains, and certainly that is a part of it, but they don't show the struggles associated with getting there. So if you as a person are only interested in being in those pictures for the views and to share them, you may not have the mental fortitude to put up with the pain and the effort and the struggle to get there. So I don't know that you can train for that, other than it has to be inherent in you and be part of the reason why you're out there to begin with. Mm-hmm. But sure, you can then, you know, when you're having a bad day in the mountains for whatever reason, you're sick or tired or cold or hungry or thirsty, you can say, well, I can deal with this for today because we're going to get to camp, it's going to be better, and tomorrow's going to be a better day. So you can tell yourself that, but if you don't have that fundamental desire to be in the mountains for the right reason, I think that's why Denali expeditions, for example, have a low success rate, because people just don't understand and don't want to be there for the good and the bad.
Right. Yeah, you have to get through all the cold and the wind or the bushes. That's one I always ask. There's a lot of people always look at these beautiful peaks in the top, and well, there's might be some bushwhacking to get there.
And some swamps.
And some swamps and some bugs and all that stuff.
Right.
And it takes a special person. And then you've been at it long enough, you know that.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. And how do you deal with those moments? I mean, you mentioned, are you just know that something positive is going to come? And
I think fundamentally I'm a very determined, motivated person, you know, maybe even to a fault. I focus on something and nothing else matters. So just my personality is such that I can deal with a lot of the unpleasant things associated with getting to the top of these mountains. And I mean, even today in the stuff that I do, which isn't the big mountains anymore, it's international peak bagging, and it's unpleasant. You're getting sick and you're sitting on buses and there's leeches and things. And so
leeches.
Unpleasant things exist really in any sport or activity. It's not all beautiful pictures. It's unpleasantness. And no matter what your passion is, if you don't have the vision to understand that there are struggles associated with reaching your goals, then you're not going to be successful. And I think that's where I have just my personality is such that I look at the big picture and say, it's going to be unpleasant for a period of time, and that's okay.
Right. Yeah. And you've seen enough of the positive, too, that I'm sure that spurs you on. That
right.
helps a lot.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think some of it, you talked about partners. Some of it is facing those struggles together with your partners.
Yeah.
I mean, 2 years ago, we did Mount Drum out above mm-hmm. Glen Allen. Mm-hmm. And I had tried it 30 years ago, failed. And I went back with Lee and Joe 2 years ago. It's supposed to be a long weekend, 3-day trip. It ended up being 12 days.
Oh, boy.
Because we were just stuck in horrendous weather.
Yeah.
And if you're with partners who have that same vision of, yeah, this sucks, it's unpleasant, but we're going to get through it. Fun isn't the right word, but it's much more bearable. I mean, maybe even fun. You know,
Okay, let's go back to that. What about food and fuel? Like, I feel like a 3-day trip, you're planning for that.
Yep. So you always know that bad weather can happen. So the one thing you can't run out of is fuel. So, you know, Mount Logan, 10 days at high camp, we never ran out of fuel.
Oh, wow.
And food, when you're not moving, you're just laying in a sleeping bag, you don't eat very much.
Yeah.
Yet when you're moving, you eat a lot. So, you know, a three-day climb of food, or maybe we took 5 days up to high camp, that's a lot of food. If you're just laying in a tent.
Yeah.
And if you theoretically never eat more than half your remaining food, you never run out of food. So yeah. you end up getting hungry, but food and fuel weren't the issue. It was just a matter of, we ended up having to rebuild. Our snow walls ended up being triple thick, 6 foot tall, because they would keep being eroded.
Oh.
And it was a very impressive windstorm up on the ridge where we were camped.
Huh. That can get scary, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's talk about outside of Alaska. What are some of your things you've, memorable climbs outside of Alaska?
So when I was doing the big Alaska peaks, I also was interested in doing big peaks outside of Alaska, similar rock, ice, and snow stuff. So I did a couple trips, trip to Pakistan, again with my friend Paul. We climbed Broad Peak, just a unguided, just trip with friends. And that was pretty memorable, 2001, because at the end of the day, you know, we had a group of six of us, and only Paul and I made the true summit. So we were, if you can imagine, it's right in the foot of K2, so they're both 8,000 meter peaks, but for 7 weeks, we were just staring at K2 every day, which is beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
So we ended up making the summit after 5 weeks, just he and I on the summit of Broad Peak, looking at K2, just standing there all by ourselves, which was, and that's a pretty strong memory that I have.
Mm-hmm.
No guides, no Sherpas, we carried everything.
Huh.
That was one of the most memorable international trips I've done.
Yeah.
A couple of years ago, I went to Kazakhstan, did a couple shorter, 14 and 16,000 foot peaks, but similar glacier and snow and ice climbing.
Yeah.
Pretty fun. But as I age, I'm 58 right now, being cold on these extended trips is not as fun as it used to be. My toes get colder than they used to be.
Yeah.
So the last 10 years, I would say, I've been doing a lot more peak bagging, international peak bagging.
Mm-hmm.
So not so much big glaciated high peaks, but going to countries and hiking up peaks that are important to them. Like Indonesia, for example, many, many, many volcanoes there. Really, really fun hiking. Great place to go.
Yeah.
Turkey, Greece, and so many places around the world have peaks that aren't glaciated. They're nice. They're fun. They're hikes. Sometimes overnight hikes. You get to see a new culture, travel in new countries. You know, so I think I've traveled in over 80 countries around the world and probably climbed in almost 70 of those countries.
Wow.
Peak bag, technical climbing, but
right. That's
what I've been spending, and even more so the last 5 years. I retired almost 3 years ago, and I'm out of the country maybe half the year, just going to different countries.
Yeah,
I went to 25 countries each of the last 3 years, climbing just places on the map that I haven't been, and I wanted to go see them.
That's fun. Let's talk about the peak bagging culture here for a second. And before we do that, you are listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Paul Twardock, and we have Dave Hart in the studio with us talking about his very productive climbing career. So the peak bagging, I know there's a website you're on, Pete Bagler or something, and people track these things. It's like bird watchers keeping track of their birds, right? Listers.
It's very much like that. So, yeah. So mountain climbing is a very, very broad spectrum. You know, there's rock climbing, ice climbing, hardcore alpine climbing, and then there's peak bagging, which typically is easier, hiking. It doesn't necessarily have to be only hiking. It can be climbing, but it's really list ticking. So if you're a peak bagger, you care about what you do for whatever reason. So it can be, I want to do all the Colorado 14ers because they're 14,000 feet. Or I want to do all the 120 peaks in the Chugach because it's on a list of the 120 Chugach. So peak baggers typically are list tickers. Mm-hmm. And I didn't start out that way, but my engineering mind, you know, it kind of evolved into that. So there's a website, peakbagger.com, and an associated app where people can log their ascents. And it's really a crowdsourcing database where you can log an ascent, upload a GPS track, write a trip report. So for areas that don't receive there's not a lot of guides to, for example, international peaks, this Peak Bagger website is very helpful. So if you want to go to Uganda, for example, there's peaks there and you can see what people did, which guides they used or the GPS mm-hmm. tracks. And so that's the Peak Bagger website. Very, very important piece of information out there. Mm-hmm. And you can track your progress. And it has a visualization app where you can, like, for example, pull up all the 14,000 foot peaks in Alaska, and it'll give you a map. And if you've logged them, it's green. And if you haven't logged them, it's red. And so you can do that on a global basis and say, okay, there's a lot of red in China, for example. I've never been to China. There's a lot of red dots in China. I'd like to go there someday and hike some of these red dots. So Peak Bagger is growing. I mean, a lot of people in Alaska use it to track their progress up the peaks.
Right. And does it get competitive in any way?
I guess you could say that, but in a fun way. I mean, there's no fame or fortune to be made by peak bagging, so you don't do it in a bad way, but competitively in that you can see if there's a mountain that you haven't done, you can see which of your buddies haven't done it, and you can say, hey, let's go do this. None of us have done it.
Yeah.
But there's also lists on Peak Bagger where people do have a healthy competition.
Uh-huh.
And that turns some people off, and I understand that, and other people it motivates them to get out. So I'm on the motivation aspect of that competition aspect of the peak bagging website.
I know birding, I'm a little more familiar with the birding lister thing. There are people that are like, oh, no, I'm not a lister, and there's people that are really obsessed with it. And then there's people who are like, oh, I'm not really a lister, but they really are. Is that the same with peak baggers?
that's a very appropriate analogy. I mean, a couple of my peak bagging buddies are also birders, and so they're obsessive compulsive, not that much, but they like the list aspect of both the birding and the peak bagging.
Yeah.
So it's very, very similar. And maybe other sports have the same thing. I don't know.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. I'm interested. So that sort of peak bagging, and I'm sort of, has that changed the climbing culture? And let's talk about other changes. We talked about communication and information, but how else has our internet age affected the climbing?
It's made it significantly easier.
Yeah.
Every area used to have hard copy guidebooks and they would quickly go out of date. But now with online guide information being real time, it's made it easier. So those that choose to use that information, which I do, it makes things much easier.
Yeah.
You know, the Alaska peaks that we did, there was no GPS tracks. You kind of knew where they started and where they finished, but you kind of had to figure it out. It doesn't make the technical aspect any easier with this information because you're still climbing the same mountain, but it takes away some of the mystery. And that's the nice thing about online information in the digital age. You can either choose to use it or not. It doesn't, it's, you know, those that choose to use it, you know, maybe it makes it easier. Those that choose not to use it, you know, maybe they get a fuller experience. I don't know.
Do you think it has increased the number of people out there? And is that good or bad?
I think what has increased the number of people out there, I think when people spend time in the outdoors for the right reason and they can now more easily share those experiences. Other people say, well, that looks like fun.
Yeah.
And, you know, some people then join the sport or spend more time outdoors for what I call the right reason, because they actually enjoy it. I think, though, a lot of people who do some of these things are doing it for the wrong reason.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm being judgmental, but they like to show them. I mean, I post stuff on my Facebook page, but really just so I can remember what I did and share with friends and family.
Right.
But I think some people use social media for the wrong reason, and that then attracts people.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's just the age we live in.
Right. Yeah. And do people, have you noticed any trends in people getting in over their heads? Like someone goes, oh, look at those pretty pictures. I can go do that. When maybe they really shouldn't be going up flat top or a P3 or whatever. You know?
Yeah, there is probably some of that.
Yeah.
You talked about the education and safety aspect of spending time in the hills. There's so many things that can bite you out there. And if you don't have that experience, you don't realize what it is that can bite you. So I suspect there are probably people who are getting into places where they shouldn't be. I think it's probably more of a lower 48 thing. I think Alaskans are pretty hardy and understand, maybe more so than people in the big city who want to go to the mountains and don't understand it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems to be. We did a show on search and rescue on a panel discussion, and that was something that group was like, well, we wish everybody would go climb, you know, flat top. They do a lot of rescues off of flat top, right? Because of just it's going to be a gnarly place.
Mm-hmm.
And they were sort of wishing that social media had some sort of more filters in it for that kind of thing.
I'm a libertarian, so I think if people want to go do something silly, you know, you can't stop them. You can't regulate people's silliness.
Yeah, it's true. There's no way to do that. We've proven that over the years. Let's talk about the Mountaineer Club of Alaska and the Alaska Mountain Rescue Group. You've been involved a little in both, especially MCA. Talk about that organization a bit and why it's important to you and what they do.
Yes, as I mentioned earlier, when I moved here in 1990, I joined the MCA so that I could meet people and learn about Alaska and learn some skills. And 36 years later, I'm still a member of the MCA. I just went to the meeting last week. Great organization. In the digital age, it's less there's less trips than there used to be, but the things that the MCA provides is a camaraderie and a way to meet people if you're new. They also have, I think it's 8 mountain huts in the nearby Anchorage area. Great resource. Good hut trips that can be done. They provide instruction. There's an annual ice climbing festival at the Matanuska Glacier. There's a alpine climbing instruction at Mint Hut. I think there's 2 1-week classes up there. There's a crevasse rescue session. So the training aspect of the MCA for new people is unparalleled. It's cheap, $20 a year. You get a newsletter and access to the huts and free instruction. And it's a great organization.
Yeah. And what's your role been with them?
I did. So in the 90s, I held a lot of leadership roles. I think I have held every president, vice president, secretary, treasurer, editor of the Scree for a couple of years, trip
and,
leader.
And the Scree is their newsletter.
Newsletter. Right, yeah. So I used to be very, very involved in the leadership of the club.
Yeah.
And very fun, great group. Now I'm just a regular member, attend some meetings, look at the slideshows. Really interesting slideshow last week. Mark Fouts talked about when he was a teenager in Alaska in the 70s doing trips as a teenager. Just, it's hard to imagine 50 years ago, teenage high school kid just going out with Art Davidson and doing winter trips. Very amazing.
That's awesome, yeah.
Yeah.
And AMRG, Alaska Mountain Rescue Group too, right? They've been important. Yeah.
Yes. I was a member, I can't remember the years, 90, I think it was, I joined right before the avalanche on Peak 3, and I was a member for a few years. Great organization. I mean, they totally volunteer, people dedicated to rescuing people in trouble in Alaska. I mean, great organization. So, I mean, they were involved in the rescue on Peak 3.
Yeah. then those all those organizations rely on volunteers, and I think that's super important. Yeah. In the little time we have remaining, like I'm sort of curious about how your climbing career is evolving as you get older. Let's talk about your risk tolerance. You talked about more, peat bagging and just hiking up peats versus climbing. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I look back to the peaks I did when I was younger, and there's no way I could do those today. They're just longer, colder, physically more demanding, carrying big packs, more risk. And so I've evolved. I still enjoy being outside in remote wilderness with friends, climbing peaks. I mean, yesterday, Wayne Todd and I went to the Kenai, and we climbed two peaks down in the Caribou Hills.
Oh, fine.
I still enjoy being outside as much as possible climbing peaks.
Yeah.
Ideally, in places where there's not many people, if anybody.
Yeah.
So because I've evolved past some of the big Alaska peaks, so there's still some peaks I want to do up here left. But I find that I get a similar thrill in traveling to a foreign country where I don't speak the language, I don't know the culture. So I have spent a lot of time traveling and will continue to do that on my peak bagging.
Right. And you talk about cold feet and so forth, but how's the aging process? And I guess let's start with cold feet and then let's talk about risk a little bit. Obviously, as we age, we have a peak in physical abilities, and then that starts to decline, whether we like it or not.
Uh-huh.
But how else, and I think particularly with risk tolerance, I guess my question is, how do those two things converge? Like mentally, your mental willingness to take risks versus your physical ability to take risk. And there's somewhere along there where there's got to be a convergence of those two things that says, well, maybe I'm not going to do that.
Yeah.
Mount Logan again.
Exactly. So yeah. I'm still very fit. So I can go climb mountains all day long. But the recovery time is longer. I can't do big days 10 days in a row, like was required to climb Denali. I mean, I could, I'd just be slower and it'd be less pleasant.
Yeah.
And so I choose to do things that are more pleasant. But as far as the risk, I think that's a good question. I life is short and I don't want to miss out on any. So I don't like putting myself in places where if something bad happens, that there's some severe consequences associated with that.
Well, we have about a minute left. What's next? What do you have on the horizon?
Oh, I'm like I said, I retired a few years ago, so I spend a little bit of time up here and a little bit of time down in Utah where we have a place, and I spend half the year traveling around. So this year, Brazil, Norway, the Alps, Japan, maybe Indonesia. I mean, I'm always looking 6 or 12 months ahead. And
yeah.
There are some peaks in Alaska I'd like to do. Whether I actually get up them, who knows? Yeah. There's Mount Hayes up by Fairbanks. That's a great one. There's a couple peaks in the St. Elias Range, some 14ers I haven't done. Maybe I'll get there someday. There's some bigger peaks around the world. Some of the countries I'd like to go to for peak bagging are closed, political unrest. Yeah, yeah. So I'm always kind of waiting to see if that settles down a little bit. So, I mean, I've got a lifetime of bucket list items left.
Good. Well, David, thanks for joining us. My guest has been David Hart, a long time and very prolific Alaska mountaineer. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Paul.
Thanks to my guest, David Hart. We'll have links to the Alaska Mountaineering Club and peakbagger.com on the Outdoor Explorer webpage. From all the hosts at Outdoor Explorer, I'm your host, Paul Twardock. Go bag a peak, and we'll see outdoors.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. Tobin Shelby is its producer, and the program is edited by Ammon Swenson and Crystal Hyde. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed on the show are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can listen to Outdoor Explorer anytime at alaskapublic.org and in your favorite podcast app. If you have a question, comment, or a topic suggestion, email outdoorexplorer@alaskapublic.org.